So, hey everybody, welcome to Voices from the Front Lines, your host Eric Mann. You're on KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, and streaming live on the web for folks in Chicago and otherwhere on kpfk.org. You can also reach me, you can tweet me at Eric Mann Speaks, and do check out our website, www.voicesfromthefrontlines. The main subject, I think, of Voices from the Frontlines is always the black liberation struggle, its relationship to climate, its relationship to anti-imperialism, all the different people in struggle, all the voices from the front lines, which is what makes the show so important. And in studio today, we have Robin D.G. Kelly. We're going to be talking in a minute about the 25th anniversary of his just incredibly important book, Hammer and Hoe, about the Alabama Communist Party. But in terms of the endless intersection of the pain and the struggle and the possibility, it is sadly the 50th anniversary of the 16th Street Baptist Church bombing in Birmingham today. What an irony. And then we're very happy to have in struggle and from the front lines, G2 Brown. G2, you are with us now.
Hey, Brother Eric. Good to hear your voice, man. How you doing?
Good. Well, G2, we're very happy. Robin D.G. Kelly's here. And in terms of voices from the front lines, you're in the midst of a hunger strike and you're in a fight. And as they would always say, what is it that you people want? Why are you never satisfied? Rahm Emanuel just did what he thought was a great thing. I read the press releases. I'm confused. Why are you people on a hunger strike? No, seriously, what is the fight at the high school? What's this about? You've been doing pretty amazing work on both school-to-prison pipeline, but also the quality of black education combined with the militarization of education. So you've been on the front lines a long time, G2. Take us right now inside the front lines. What's happening? What are your demands? And what can we do to help?
Yes, sir. Well, first, brother, thanks for having me on. And Brother Kelly, it's good to connect with you as well.
It's my honor.
Yes, sir. The honor is mine, brother. If I understand things correctly, the Bronzeville community on the south side of Chicago was one of the main destinations when black people evacuated the south in the early part of the 20th century. When you look at sort of what was the black metropolis in the United States, you have to look at, you know, Harlem, New York, Bronzeville, in Chicago, South Side, Kansas City, Missouri, you know, places like that. It's a historic community. It's the same community that gave us Nat King Cole, Bobby Wright, Gwendolyn Brooks, Harold Washington, Captain Walter Dyett, Red Fox. I mean, it's a historic community. Minnie Riperton, Sam Cooke, Dr. Daniel Hale Williams built Provident Hospital right across the street from Dyett High School. So this community has contributed a lot to just American life in the 20th and 21st century. But it suffered from decades of municipal and private disinvestment, really, you know, sabotaging the lives of people that live in that community, which I did for about 18 years. Really sabotaging every basic quality of life institution, and nowhere was that disinvestment more stark than I think not just public but affordable housing and schools. And so Dyett High School is our last open enrollment neighborhood high school in that community. Every other high school is either charter or selective enrollment, as the community of Bronzeville is about 10 minutes from downtown Chicago and right off the lakefront. So I've served on the local school council at Dyett since about 2003, and the school, it was once a very popular middle school, but as the area gentrified, they turned Martin Luther King High School into Martin Luther King College Prep, and that means the children that lived across the street from King can no longer go, so then they made Dyett with 3 months' notice a high school. diet never received the resources it deserved. As a matter of fact, when I joined the LSC in 2003, the first graduating class had never even had access to honors class. So we did a lot of work. We hired an excellent principal. We did a lot of work to bring resources into the school. And in 2008, we had the largest increase of students going to college in the whole city, the largest decrease in arrest and suspensions for 2 years. And the response of Chicago Public Schools to that success was to snatch away every program and initiative that we had put in place. So,
G2, is that because they actually felt your success was a political threat?
Absolutely, because while I'm the national director for the Journey for Justice now, I come from the oldest African-American grassroots community organization in the city, the Kenwood Oakland Community Organization, or COCO is the acronym.
Right.
And we are a power-building organization in the hood. And you don't have a lot of black organizing groups anymore. A lot of our organizations do social services, which hamstrings us because if you're getting money from the city, you're getting money from the state, then you're very hesitant to hold them accountable.
Right.
That's no critique. That's just, you know, because people do good work, but we have to understand the difference between, you know, service providers and community organizers. So.
And what is the front line? The background is great. At the present cutting edge, given this amazing work, what's the beef with Emmanuel? What's our fight right now?
The fight right now is the fact that we've been rendered voiceless. Since 2009, we've been trying to work with Chicago Public Schools on a K-12 vision of education in our neighborhood, not only Diet, but several of his feeder schools. We developed a plan for Walter Diet Global Leadership and Green Technology High School as the hub of a sustainable community school village, light years ahead of anything that the district has even developed themselves. And the issue is that for political reasons, they won't support it. So we had to put a different type of pressure on Rahm Emanuel. So you people may have seen the footage of him being ran off the stage at a citywide budget hearing with 750 people all talking about Diet High School. And so this is the 30th day of the hunger strike. There were originally 12 of us. There's 16 now. And people are struggling. I mean, we had two people come off today because one sister has now had heart damage. Another sister has didn't have high blood pressure before this, but now she has high blood pressure. She has to take high blood pressure medication. So they don't care if we die. And I'll never be the same after this experience in regards to my understanding of racism and how our black and brown children are so devalued in this society. So the beef now is the community wants Walter Diet Global Leadership and Green Technology. Now, we've had some accomplishments. Last year, we made them commit to reopening it. This year, we stopped them from privatizing it. So it will be a public school. But they now are saying it's going to be an art school. And the community's concern with that is the biggest growth industry in the United States is green technology. And the one industry that has the highest rate of unemployment, the arts. So why? And then, you know, we already have a thriving youth farm right next to Diet High School. We have a pond and a nature observatory in Washington Park. It's the fastest growing industry in the world. So why not green technology? And it's the reasons are all political, you know, and it's almost like, how dare you have self-determination? Now, check this out. While we're starving ourselves, And you know, haven't eaten, and we all struggle. I've lost 34 pounds.
Wow.
We're having rapid weight loss. It's no joke. This is serious. And while the mayor refuses to adhere to the community demand, you know, last Thursday they did a ribbon cutting for a school called, a $21 million annex at a school called Lincoln Elementary in the Lincoln Park neighborhood, which is upper middle class white neighborhood. Wow, these people didn't even have to burp, let alone sweat, to get this. And there's no acrimony towards them because their children deserved it. But so do our children. And that's the piece that I think with this hunger strike has made us so committed to seeing this through, because we don't have failing schools. We've been failed. And it's a trust betrayed, you know, and that's what's resonating with people, because people see the two-tiered system. They see that some children in different parts of the city that aren't communities of color have Mandarin Chinese, Arabic, and Spanish in elementary school. Then you have every teacher with a teacher's aide, but then you have black schools on the south and west side with no librarian.
Due to what?
With one teacher aide in the entire building. So this fight is not just about Dyett High School. It's about creating sustainable systems of education in black and brown communities around this country. And it has to be, it can only be done if it's community driven.
Well, Jitu, let me ask you this. Jitu, when you and I talked earlier, you're so much in the tradition of Ocean Hill Brownsville and IS-201 and why there was such threat against black community control of schools. Given that Rahm Emanuel, you know, came close to losing, and given the vulnerability, what can people at a national level do to help? And we're going to have you on next week for some even more detail. But right now, I want to make sure, given that you are truly putting your body on the line, we're trying to get our voices listeners to become voices organizers. What is the ask? What is the ask, and what is the demand?
Yes, sir. It's three things. One, I think people can call Mayor Rahm Emanuel at 312-744-3300. Tell him, why not green technology? We support Walter Dyett Global Leadership at Green Technology High School, and the world is watching. That's one concrete thing that people can do.
Got it.
Another thing is we're doing a Twitter storm tonight, starting at 9 p.m. your time, Pacific time. And it's hashtag fight, F-I-G-H-T, 4-F-O-R, diet, D-Y-E-T-T. So I think those are two things that people can do to just stay with us on social media. And there'll be, and through that venue, people will, when there's time for other actions or other things we're asking people to do, like we're going to be live streaming from in front of the president's house, because his house is 3.5 blocks from this school. And so there's a lot of things that people can do to connect and to spread the word.
Jitu, how do we reach your organization?
They can call the Journey for Justice Alliance or the Kenwood Oakland Community Organization, and they can ask for me at 773-548-7500. I do want to say that there's conversations happening now with the district, so there's significant pressure on them. They don't look good, and I think that needs to continue. So we did give them a set of demands, and we are, conversating. I won't say we're negotiating yet, but I say we are having conversations, which is a step forward.
Well, Jitu Brown, thank you for the amazing work you do. It's a good thing about having an organization, because I can't get our listeners yet to grasp the role of discipline, is the Strategy Center is going to move on all these things. I can promise you, my brother, that we will be participating in the Twitter storm. We will be organizing, and Voices is going to put out tomorrow morning. You hear that, Channing Martinez? We're going to put out a call tomorrow morning to the Voices list with all the things that you're asking for, and we are committing to have you on next Tuesday at 4, hopefully to announce victory. Mm-hmm. And I mean that. And, you know, you and I are going to be in touch through the Strategy Center to continue this work going.
Yeah.
You brothers be safe, man.
Yeah, I just want to say thank you for your work, because I've been following the struggle, and it's probably the most important struggle right now at this moment. And I just hope that all the listeners could follow these three points and weigh in. I know I will.
So we're talking about Rahm Emanuel, 312-744-3300. The message is, give them what they want. That's the message. Mm-hmm. Give them what they want. Twitter storm tonight at 9 p.m. Pacific at Fight for Diet, D-Y-E-T-T. By the way, Jitu, great history, by the way. And call Journey for Justice, 773-548-7500, and you can get to talk to the man himself. So hang in there, Jitu. We'll be in touch, and we'll talk to you, if not sooner, next Tuesday.
All right, brother. I appreciate your support. It's just like a sandwich.
That's the highest compliment right now. Thank you, Jitu.
All right, stay up, man.
Take good care of yourself.
All right, peace.
All right. So, everybody, I think you understand, you should understand the incredible historical importance of this radio show. Because, look, we didn't create this radio. I mean, I spent a lot of time preparing for this show. This is a movement show. The reason why it's important is because of G2 Brown. It's important because of Ashley Franklin and the young people trying to get the tanks out of the Los Angeles School Board. It's, we get people on there. It's called Voices from the Front Lines. So you got somebody there, a man on a hunger strike. It's, if you've ever been on a hunger strike, it's not funny. I mean, he's being incredibly good sport about this, but it eats away at you. It has a very bad effect on the mind and the body, which is why it's supposed to have the moral impact. But this is not a very moral society. So we got to turn it out. I want you, first of all, to send me an email. One reason it's important, Eric, at Voices from the Front Lines, is so I know you're out there. This is your reporting in. You say, look, as some of you have done, I called Rahm Emanuel at 312-744-3300, Eric. I did it. I did participate in the Twitter storm tonight at 9 p.m. Pacific at Fight for a Diet. I did call the Journey for Justice and go online and find their website at 773-548-7500. If a man is leading a struggle and it says he hasn't eaten, could the least you do is call his office and indicate some solidarity. Morale in a war is critical. We're in a war. Support, it's a material phenomenon, and support is a material phenomenon. We want them to win. So that's the difference about Voices from the Front Lines. We call fight to win. We're not fighting the good fight. We're fighting the fight to win. So I'm deeply moved. Robin's deeply moved. We're going to move because we want to. And we need you to do the same at Eric at Voices from the Front Lines. And yeah, tweet me at Eric Mann Speaks and say, I've done it, or that you heard the show, and we'll forward it around. So I'm in studio with Robin D.G. Kelly, who, among other things, is a professor of Black Studies and History at UCLA. He's the author of Freedom Dreams and the Black Radical Imagination, Thelonious Monk, and Our American, A Life, I think, an American original, mm-hmm. Race Rebels, and the book that we're going to talk about today, Hammer and Hoe, Alabama Communists During the Great Depression. Very nice to have you on the show, Robin.
It's always a pleasure to be with you, Eric.
Well, I was thinking, you know, I always make lists, so I was thinking of if I was on this hypothetical desert island, where it would probably be called Los Angeles at the rate global warming was going, or Tuvalu. So I had to figure out, well, what would be the books I would take? So I would take Serkin and Georgiakis, Detroit, I Do Mind Dying, mm-hmm. V.I. Lenin's What Is to Be Done, Clay Carson's In Struggle, SNCC and the Black Awakening in the 60s. Of course, my Bible, W.E.B. Du Bois' Black Reconstruction America. Mao's Investigation into the Peasant Movement, Hunan. Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man. Vijay Prashad's The Darker Nations. Mm-hmm. People's History of the Third World. The Black Woman by Tony K. Bambara. Marx and Engels' The Communist Manifesto. Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, An Indigenous People History of the United States. My friend Rudy Acuna's Occupied America, A History of Chicanos. Harry Haywood's Black Bolshevik. Mm-hmm. And Robin Kelly's Hammer and Hoe, Alabama Communists During the Great Depression. So you're both in with some pretty cool people.
Yeah, it's good company. Yeah.
Pretty good company, right? And in return, they're in very good company. You know, I like all your books, but this is the one I do come back mm-hmm. to the most. Tell us, since the book starts in the consciousness of a human being, and there is a new introduction, who was the human being who wrote this? Who was that person when you first got this idea?
Who was the person? Well, at the time I wrote the book, and I actually want to make some connections to what G2 Brown was talking about, and also the fact that this is the 50th anniversary of the murder of those four girls, and something else that you and I have been talking about, that is the reality of genocide. The genocide is, you know, in some ways defines the last, you know, half millennia. It defines modernity. And so where I fit in relationship to this history of genocide, one, I mean, I was born a year before these children were killed, you know, at a time when my parents had to think about their future, when on the one hand they saw the possibility of something being defined as freedom by a civil rights movement, however limited it might be, sure. But also seeing the price that had to be paid. And so, you know, that's the world I grew up in. So by the time I got to the point where I got interested in the left, it was being in left organizations, coming out of movements that, you know, taught me that it's not enough to get the right to vote. It's not enough to desegregate, that actually you need a revolution, you know. And my commitment to being part of a movement to make that revolution happen led me to assess or reassess the Communist Party. I mean, when I was in grad school at UCLA in the 80s, on the one hand, I was active in a lot of it. I talk about this in the introduction, being part of the anti-apartheid movement, being involved in black student politics. But most importantly, I was, you know, part of a left organization and had to come to terms with the limitations of capitalism, that capitalism was not sustainable. And when I announced to my committee that I'm writing a book on the Communist Party, and this initially was the Communist Party in South Africa and the South, they were like, well, you know, if you write about communists in the South or in Alabama, can you get 10 pages? I mean, they said, you got to have at least a couple of hundred pages for a dissertation. And I don't think there's enough material. And so it just goes to show you how this history was completely buried, just stripped out of the kind of collective consciousness. And it also goes to show you, you know, at that point, you know, with sort of two terms of Reaganism coming to an end, with the real beginnings of the kind of neoliberal order of privatizing everything and destroying education, of destroying the kind of public institutions that, no matter how limiting they were, sustain many of us. That's the moment I'm trying to write this book. You know, and also, I should say, at a moment when Reagan is declaring a victory in the Cold War, when the Soviet Union is on the verge of collapse, when, you know, it became common sense that socialism is no longer on the table. Communism is dead and capitalism was victorious. That's the world in which I wrote this book and published it.
Well, you know, when you and I met, you know, 20 plus years ago, and we sort of began having a similar master narrative, and we were both so excited that we had read a lot of the same books and had a lot of the same sort of the long, long story. In Harry Haywood's book, Black Bolshevik, he tells this great story about his move from Marcus Garvey to the Communist Party, to his belief in a black nation in the South. Why don't you tell that story? Because that does frame black communists in Alabama with a product of, you know, you talk about Garveyism, you talk about certain people who criticized the Freedmen's Bureau in the South. These were very conscious people. So why don't you tell our listeners the rise of Garveyism and why important that was, and how did Garveyism end up influencing communism and vice versa?
Right. That's an excellent question, because I think sometimes we underestimate both Garveyism and the extent to which black people actually joined and supported the Communist Party. So in a nutshell, the Communist Party, as it emerged with the Third International right around 1920, Garveyism was sort of at its height. And many of the many people on the left, black and others, realized that this was the most powerful independent force, political force. The Garvey movement was the largest international organization of black people in history. And so initially, some of the early communists wanted to sort of take over the Garvey movement. You can't do that. But that was their goal. People like Claude McKay, the great writer, who was very close to the CP, went to the Soviet Union, gave a speech in 1922, who said, look, you know, we need to pay attention to Garveyism. We need to get behind this powerful nationalist movement, because it is at the edge, the sort of knife edge of anti-imperialism. And so in some ways, you have groups like the African Blood Brotherhood in the United States, which was independent of Garveyism, right, but certainly embraced certain elements of its nationalism, but with a progressive or left agenda in South Africa, which, you know, that's a story, you know, in and of itself. The Garveyites and communists were often one and the same. There wasn't a
that's
real
right.
battle. There
that's
were
right.
people who were in the Garvey movement and in the Communist Party, because for them, they were fighting a racial regime that basically had dispossessed the whole nation. And so for them, they didn't see a difference, you know. So in some ways, it would make sense that someone like Harry Haywood and many of his comrades who had come out of World War One, who had witnessed the collapse of Europe, who had seen and built sort of international solidarity with Africans and people from the Caribbean and people from Southeast Asia who were in Europe at the time, World War One, and saw the and kind of recognize, you know, how people of color around the globe in opposition to, and I don't like that term, but how sort of subjugated nationalities in opposition to capital could represent a powerful force that really would be at the vanguard of a communist movement. And so that's the connection. And it's not an accident that in the 1930s, when the party actually began pushing for self-determination in the Black Belt South, began supporting the Scottsboro Nine, the defendants who was falsely accused of raping two white women, began to push for what we think today of as kind of human rights. That's when some of the former Garveyites joined the Communist Party. You know, people like Queen Mother Moore and others, you know.
Well, I mean, one of the things that when you read the Communist Manifesto, it does say there's a spectre haunting Europe, and it is very Eurocentric. And there's when Lenin came along and said, you know, he said, it's workers of the world, it's workers and oppressed people of the world confronting imperialism, that opened up just such an enormous opportunity. And then, so the intersection of the Garvey's influence, because just for our listeners, I mean, obviously Garveyism was superficially called the Back to Africa movement, but fundamentally it was black people sort of saying, hey, guess what? We don't like it here. You know, we are a captive people. So it wasn't just, it was, I mean, some of these ideas are so trivialized, like, well, Garvey didn't understand this. The communists, the concept of saying we don't like it here and we don't want to go, I mean, it didn't mean whether they would actually get there on a steamship. It was what the system could not hear, right? And then the second concept is when the Communist Party of the United States developed the theory of a Black Belt South and an oppressed nation in the South. My first question, or my next question is, there's a perception or a stereotype that, well, yeah, the Communist Party had that view, but black people in the South didn't really have that view, or they never talked to black people about the South in it. You know, it was one of those documents. How, and I'm asking honestly, how influential were the 1928, 1930 resolutions? Not per se, but that influence, how many real black people in the South knew that that was the policy?
Right, right. Before I answer that question,
sure.
Let me just one thing, because people think that policy came out of nowhere.
Right.
And I think it's important to recognize three really fundamental sort of origins. One is that Lenin himself, I think in 1910, had done a study of the development of capitalist agriculture in the South, the U.S.
Wow.
South. And in it, the you could see the makings of this notion that the black rural proletariat represents a powerful independent force. He didn't make the argument then that black people in the South had a right to self-determination, but he began to sort of see their role. Secondly, much of the debate around self-determination centered around black South African communists,
right,
who were in the Comintern at the time, and who had to fight to travel because the Communist Party of South Africa was initially a white man's party.
Right.
That's
right.
Another story.
Yeah.
And so when Africans did go there, they began pushing for this agenda, but it was defined in South Africa as a native republic thesis, or the idea of an independent native republic. And so the idea was circulating. Then you have Woodrow Wilson talking about self-determination, though not really meaning it, and that's another debate. But the language itself was picked up by members of the African Blood Brotherhood. The Garvey people were sort of talking about, you know, Africa for the Africans. Hubert Harrison, one of the great black socialists based in Harlem,
right,
had basically said, look, you get the League of Nations is about to give out former colonies as mandates to Europeans. Give them to black people, you know. So in some ways, that logic of self-determination was already circulating. You didn't need the Communist International to put a rubber stamp on it. But it was a space for the debate. And of course, Emin Roy, the Indian communist, had supported the idea of peasant revolt,
right,
as revolutionary. In the South, one could argue, and I don't say this in the book per se, but one could argue that acts of nation building were already taking place in the form of all these independent black towns all over Oklahoma, Langston, Boley, Oklahoma, Mound Bayou, Mississippi. These were spaces, these were towns created for black people by black people to have control over the economy, knowing that they have the economic power and wherewithal to be self-determined. And that was a space of practice. It was very difficult because the fact of the matter is you can't have independent black towns and withdraw vital black labor, cheap black labor, from sort of Jim Crow capitalism. And so those towns were always under war, under siege. Water was denied them. Night riders would come and destroy their homes. So self-determination was a very bloody matter. My point here is that it wasn't as if it's a foreign idea. It was already lived. So when that slogan was circulating, it wasn't that the black working class hearing the slogan decided to join the Communist Party. It was that the slogan suggested that they had allies, an international alliance of, you know, Soviets, communists all over the globe who recognize that they were not subjugated people, but a subjugated nation with the right to no longer be subjugated. However that turns out, if it meant seceding from the U.S., if it meant creating black institutions, or if it simply meant being able to organize armed self-defense and fight for the right for decent wages, whether it's picking cotton or working in steel mills. And so self-determination became defined in some ways as a struggle to live as full human beings with the dignity of humanity in a land where they represent a majority. And then finally, something as basic as the right to vote, which we sometimes take for granted, was an essential part of that definition. If we can't vote under this regime, we create our own, you know.
Well, one thing I still want to go back to, I think that really is great, is I still want to argue that the external role of communism, in the good sense of being external, the, you know, as Lenin said, consciousness comes from the outside. There's a limit to our consciousness. So we had, on one hand, a true indigenous, you could even say an indigenous communism that black people were trying to figure out. On the other hand, in like Angelo Herndon, is that his correct name?
Herndon, yeah.
Herndon, right? Okay. People like that, like I'm reading, you're saying things like what people said, don't cut off the welfare, and this, and also the Soviet Union. Or they'll say, down with the Red Cross, but we also want the right to vote.
Right.
And it was so striking to me about how the black communists in particular, but communists in general, were able to sort of get deep into people's direct, and contrary again, because there's so much anti-communism, rather than tack on, integrate broader theories into the popular conversation so people could be marching. There is a joke, I will tell, actually it's worth a minute. the joke would be, you know, the boss, this is a Jewish communist joke, the guy would say, you know, all right, you got a wage increase, okay, I stopped the speed up, but I can't give you self-determination in the Black Belt South, I'm sorry. You know? And the fact that the people brought it up as a demand, you know, in every different struggle, or I can't support the Soviet Union, was that was the joke. But the joke, it was, that's what was funny about it, is they actually did it. Is that right. fair?
Oh, yeah. No, that's, not only is that fair, but, I mean, one of the big misconceptions, and we were talking about this earlier, or misreadings of the book, is this idea that somehow a group of black working people, rural and urban, using the name of the Communist Party, develop a wholly independent sort of kind of early civil rights movement.
Right,
and
right.
it's not that at all. They develop a communist movement, and one based on international solidarity. And I'll give you a really good example. The Sharecroppers Union in Tallapoosa County, Alabama, you know, this is another sort of Piedmont County, not quite the Black Belt, and they had an intense struggle fighting for a dollar a day picking cotton. And they had picnics and other kinds of things organized under the Young Communist League, under the Young Pioneers, under the Communist Party. And at one of their demonstrations, this is the countryside, you know, they were demanding a dollar a day. They were making those demands. But they also said, we want freedom. We want the German state to free Ernst Thälmann.
Right.
Ernst Thälmann was one of the leading communists in Germany under Hitler. And so they're putting out leaflets. These are black communists putting out leaflets in rural Alabama saying, free Ernst Thälmann now. You know? So now, of course, the planters can come up and say, well, we can give you a dollar day, but we can't free Ernst Thälmann.
Right.
You know? But the fact that they believed, for example, that if something were to go down in Alabama, some violent acts, that Stalin would send troops through Mobile, that the Soviet Union was an ally, that they were no longer alone, but they were connected to communists in Kenya, in South Africa, in Europe, Soviet Union, in China, that people had these conversations about what's going on around the world. And that deep sense of solidarity, I think, was unique. And most importantly, they were also envisioning a future that was a socialist future.
Right.
Whether it came from a reading of the Bible or the reading of Lenin, usually came from both, this idea that the land ought to be redistributed, that the means of production should be in the control of those who labor. That idea was not, it's not a natural idea.
That's right.
You know, it's an idea that's related to the ideas of the Communist Party, and that's what made them different from the civil rights movement that they helped actually spawn later.
The voice you're listening to is Robin D.G. Kelly. The book we're talking about, which you really have to get, I mean, you just got to get, is called Hammer and Hoe, Alabama Communists During the Great Depression. Rob and I are already talking about a Strategy Center book event sometime in early 2016 around this book. God, there's so many things I want to talk about. I'm already thinking this could be a five-hour show, but tell us about some real people. I mean, like the, I learned so many things, and I haven't even done the reread. But like, I did not know or remember that in 1932 the Communist Party ran and was allowed to run an elect. That's the same year that Roosevelt first ran, and William Z. Foster ran for president. Mm-hmm. I did not remember James Ford, that they ran a black man for vice president of the United right. States. And it said he was from Alabama, he was a steel worker, and a Fisk graduate, which is also so many stereotypes people don't get. Well, wait a minute, I understand. First he's a communist, then he ran for vice president. Oh, a steel worker, but then he went to Fisk. Tell us about him, and then tell us about Angela Herndon, just as two, right. and maybe we can get to a couple of others. Make them come alive for our listeners.
Right, right. Yeah, James Ford was originally from Alabama. He didn't come back. He did get a telegram when he ran for office, and Foster was going to campaign in Alabama. He decided not to come through, but the Klan sent him a telegram, said, you know, we don't want Foster, send Nigger Ford, right. you know. You're chilling. And so Ford himself was very much committed party member. When he ran that year, 1932, he also ran, I mean, the Communist Party also put up state candidates,
right.
including a black person as lieutenant governor, right. Lewis. And so, of course, we can look at these things as symbolic, But they're not just symbolic because they're also part of a demand, the demand to extend democracy, same demand made in Reconstruction, that democracy should be sort of the possession of all. If we go to someone like Angela Herndon, interesting figure, born in Ohio, ends up, you know, in the South, gets arrested in Georgia in the Georgia chain gang, and there's a big campaign around his release. But even before that, he ended up being one of the early communists in Alabama, working among the unemployed, and, you know, very intelligent young man. Like so many of the communists, were kind of self-taught. When I say self-taught, taught in the context of the education that the party gave you. That is, you know, so many people like Hosea Hudson and Henry O. Mayfield and many of these working class black men and women, you know, Cornelia Forman, they couldn't read or write until the party basically brought them in. And their literacy was a product of what they learned in the party. And so to go back to Herndon, Herndon ends up, you know, he's freed from the Georgia prison. He was actually arrested and jailed on an old anti-sedition, but really pro-slavery legislation. And then he travels around speaking on behalf of the party and behalf of the Scottsboro Nine. Eventually, he and Ralph Ellison edit a publication together. And he leaves the party eventually. He, in fact, he's accused of petty bourgeois nationalism. And he just sort of kind of disappears. But he, if you look at the trajectory of his whole life, forged in the countryside and cities of Birmingham, Georgia, imprisoned, committed to the party and to justice, and eventually becoming a kind of independent intellectual and writer and thoughtful figure.
Well, and I think it's fair to say that both of you and I consider ourselves very pro-communist, but also having been in a communist organization and knowing the contradictions of that point of view, the party's problems of grasping its own united front, the party, like I was called many petty bourgeois things when I was in a communist organization for not attacking the president of my union, you know, really, or not fighting with people in the Communist Labor Party who were friendly with the Soviet Union. I was accused of being a pro-Soviet force because I didn't want to destroy my union. So I don't have a romantic pro-communism. Right. I know it only too well. But I'm still, as I keep studying. So let's talk about the petty bourgeois nationalism, meaning that the party said it wanted a national liberation movement. But when black people got very nationalistic, this was still an overwhelmingly white party.
Right.
It was a black communist Alabama party. Let's talk about that contradiction and how many people the party drove out of the party for maybe taking the line a little more seriously than they thought they should.
Right, right.
Is that fair, again?
That's fair. And part of the context for that is when the party had shifted its position, because for some listeners may not know this story, but if we begin in 1928, when the Communist International supported black self-determination, then, you know, they were pushing for alliances with what we may think of as black nationalist organizations. They may be critical of them,
right,
but they formed organizations like the League of Struggle for Negro Rights, which Langston Hughes was the first president, if I recall.
Wow.
They had the American Negro Labor Congress. They, you know, and then 1935, when the party shifted its position with the 7th Communist Congress and said, we need to build a popular front against fascism, it became defined in terms of kind of tamping down the independent nationalism,
right,
and supporting, building, in the South at least, building alliances with Southern white intellectuals. Now, Southern white intellectuals are probably the worst friends of communism.
That's right. That's right.
You know, this is not New York City. These are Jim Crow intellectuals. And so it was a bad policy and damaging. And, you know, and I've gotten a lot of flack in the book because many of my colleagues who write about the Communist Party see the Popular Front as an opening, as the expansion, as building new networks, whereas in the South, in Alabama, it had the opposite effect. It built certain networks, but also undermined the independent black struggle. Or it didn't undermine it. It separated itself from it, and it ended up going its own independent way. However, in that period, an organization emerged called the Southern Negro Youth Congress, which was a communist organization for the most part, full of people who were not necessarily Communist Party members. James Jackson, Esther Cooper Jackson, Dorothy Burnham, Lewis Burnham, Augusta Strong, Ed Strong. These were like amazing organizers, young, black, mostly Southern-born, who intellectuals who built a movement which really, in some ways, set the stage for a later SNCC, that's Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, right. Who laid the foundations for CORE. And they lasted from 37 to about 1948, when they were ultimately destroyed by the Cold War and by Bull Connor. But that organization's worth studying because they tried their best to maintain what we can think of as petty bourgeois nationalism, and that is building a black movement that's independent, that focuses on issues like basic human rights, while also, you know, organizing or supporting sharecroppers, steel workers. Imagine the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, which was an organization that dealt with the countryside, dealt with workers, dealt with unions and the right to vote. That spirit was embodied in the Southern Negro Youth Congress, you know.
Well, let me go back to something. This is Eric Mann talking with Robin G.G. Kelly. And I want to take back, I'm not going to use the word, is that fair anymore? That's not a good concept. Because what I'm really saying is I have a point of view. Do you agree with it? And let me say, I think we're saying a similar thing, but I want our listeners to understand that part of the, this is my view, that trying to judge revolutionary movements by people that are not revolutionaries is pathetic. I mean, they should have done this, they should have done that. Look, folks, we all could have done a million things. There are forks in the road. They're very difficult forks. So on one hand, you had the Soviet Union by 1933, 34, 35, realizing that the United States had no intention of fighting Hitler, and nor did Germany, I mean, nor did England, nor did France. And they wanted Hitler to invade the Soviet Union. So they had, if you believed, as I would in 1935, let's say, that the protection of the Soviet Union might be the primary strategic objective of the whole world, I would argue that. And therefore, compromises of other things might be necessary. So if you're trying to build pressure on Roosevelt, because that's what this is about, the Popular Front is how do you get, a pro-fascist liberal Roosevelt, you know, a racist liberal Roosevelt with the solid South, how do you move him? So the Communist Party sends out, the Comintern sends out a mandate and says to the local parties, look, maybe we've been a little too sectarian, maybe we've been a little too nationalist, maybe a little too feminist, we got to tone it down a little bit, and we have to reach out more broadly. All right, as I would say, so far so good on the theory. But Mao said, yeah, I get it, Stalin, but no, I'm not going to capitulate to the Kuomintang because you want me to. I'm not going to move so far to the right. So Mao wrote about what he called independence and initiative in the United Front. He said, we accept the concept of a united front against imperialism, a united front against fascism, but as communists, we have our own independent role to play. Otherwise, after the war, they're going to eat our lunch. After the war, we're going to be defeating fascism, and we the communists, want to come to power. So if the black movement inside the Communist Party was coming to power and communism was becoming a real force in the black community, and the black community was becoming a real force in the Communist Party, protecting that would have been a critical objective, even if it meant more struggle with Roosevelt. Yeah. And I think the historical criticism of the Communist Party is, and not every party did that, it's the U.S. party's flip, yeah. It was called flip-flop. Mao did not flip-flop. Mao applied dialectics. The U.S. party went, okay, we got it, and I'm asking, this is my effort and interpretation, squandered tremendous work that they had done in the black community by being more threatened by black nationalism at a time when Roosevelt, not, in other words, if you thought you were going to overthrow capitalism, right, then black nationalism was great. But if Roosevelt is a racist, right, and he doesn't want to hear anything about black nationalism, my interpretation is the party subordinated the black national question in the interest of too much unity and not enough struggle with Roosevelt.
I completely agree, and I would even add one twist, sure, to that story. First of all, what I didn't mention was when the Black Belt thesis was proposed in 28 and then reintroduced in 1930, the U.S. party didn't,
right,
support
that's
it.
Correct.
They didn't push it.
That's right.
And part of the reason they didn't push it was because it wasn't just their opposition to black nationalism, it was their fear of black leadership.
Right.
And then I want to be real clear on this because I agree that under the circumstances in 1935, yes, the Popular Front position took, you know, made sense. It was the interpretation of
that
position in the South. And that interpretation was based on an older idea that there's no possible way you can have a party that's led by black people. And this is very interesting,
yes,
because
right,
in 1928-29, I write about this in the book, the Daily Work of the party's newspaper kept talking about, you know, we imagine attracting young white workers to the party. That was how they imagined the party would look.
That's right.
But that's not what they got. In spite of their best efforts, all these black people showed up and said, we're ready to fight.
That's right.
And then they had to deal with them. And so what ends up happening after 35 is bending over backwards to attract white liberals didn't work. But what did happen, again, was that in spite of the party's local efforts, these black intellectuals in Southern Negro Youth Congress really took up the banner and developed an agenda and a radical vision that really shaped what would be the next generation of civil rights activists.
Well, I want to end, because there is no end, to urging a couple of things. I mean, I really want to say that at this show, we say again, we need you to help the Chicago parents and activists in Chicago. I need you to buy Harrow and Hoe. I felt badly that I only reread maybe three chapters, but I realized I had 9 questions per page. I mean it, because there's so many things. Frankly, the more you know, the more you see. So there were discussions of organizing. There were discussions of white women, which is fascinating. There were discussions of armed struggle. There was struggle of people joined the party because they wanted to hit cops upside the head. There was, I mean, on one page, we could have done an hour,
right,
let alone one chapter. So one thing you need to know about Rotman's writing is it's a denseness, and I have to say, at the level of Du Bois, meaning it's hard to read Du Bois for more than 3 pages because there's so many ideas popping off the page, you got to read slow. And the value of reading is you can read slow. And I urge you to read Hammer and Hoe. We are going to do an event on this book. And Robin, just a pleasure to have you on. We obviously going to have you on back every day, I think. We'll just do it. Any last thoughts for our listeners?
No, it's great, and I just hope that people keep listening to the show and today think about the constant death that's taking place between these young people in Chicago and those 4 little girls. There's a relationship between them, and we need to meditate on that and act.
And we need the black radical and the black communist tradition if there's any hope. So this is Eric Mann. You're on Voices from the Front Lines. I want to thank the board operator and engineer, Kiana, who I'm just getting to know. I want to thank Robin Kelly for just the prolific work. I want to thank Channing Martinez, the producer, who really is stepping up to be a producer and doing a heck of a good job. And I want to thank the listeners at Voices from the Front Lines, because you are out there. You're doing a great job. And like I say, it may be gold, but it's still the best I can come up with. All power to the people.